woke up this morning with the sun down shining in him.
Oh. Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis.
I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sun down shining in
here. Lone Wolf Bank, Stacks, and Jacks. I'm talking about Greg on the board. S&P futures down 13. NASDAQ futures down 46. Dow futures down 83. Nothing crazy as we notched another new high yesterday in the S&P futures. We just seem to have a bid under everything. Not sure where that's coming from. I have my suspicions, but... We won't go into those today. We do those all the time. Do we have Professor Lou?
Good morning, sir.
How are you, bud?
Good. Cold. It's cold out here. Of course, you guys are cold too. So
we got a couple more days
from us.
A couple more days.
Interesting weather phenomena, and I don't want to sound like two old guys talking about the weather, but interesting weather phenomena here in Denver is that this thing air mass is pushed down from the north and push down east of us, so you get this effect where the cold air, you know, moves west into the Denver area and then bumps up against the mountains. And if there's not enough of a push from the cold air mass to our east, the cold air doesn't make it over the mountains. So it is much warmer, for example, at our place at 9,500 feet, but which is on the opposite side of the mountain range, the Rampart Range from Denver. It's much warmer there than it is here at, you know, 4,000 feet lower. So sort of an interesting turnaround. And you'll be happy to know the ski areas got hammered with snow over the last couple of days, and I think they're going to get hammered again this weekend.
Well, that's always, for them, there's never enough, right? Unless, actually there was,
no.
There was, that one year they had so much that you couldn't ski half the time.
Yeah, it when it all falls at once, and of course, from their perspective, from a strictly commercial perspective, the problem is when you get more than a couple of inches at one time, the routes in and out of there become impassable, because Colorado, unlike Chicago, has decided it's not going to manage snow on the roads properly. So the Eisenhower Tunnel, I mean, there was a 38-mile backup, an I-70 going eastbound to get to back home to Denver on President's Day weekend because of crashes at the Eisenhower Tunnel. And, you know, they don't put salt down, they won't put chemicals down on the road to melt the snow. So any snowfall, if it's cold enough, and it was, stays there. And, you know, people come up in rear-wheel drive vehicles, and, you know, trucks come up in with not great tires, and they can't get up the hill. They spin out on the hill going up to Eisenhower Tunnel on the
I hate it when that happens. Side. I hate it when that happens.
Yeah, yeah. And so it took, I think that, you know, the Denver Post solicits horror stories on that road, and I think there were people that said it took 10 hours to get the, whatever it is, 100 miles from this Breckenridge to Denver.
Well, I've in all my years I used to drive out skiing, we had some interesting stuff going on out there. I mean, it was, we always seemed to be okay with that. I love the, Greg, if you've never seen it, you know how you have the plow shove stuff over to the side? Well, they do that there as well. I'm talking about like an I-40 up the Steamboat or something. They keep shoving it over. There's big shoulders and these roads. I mean, the roads are two-lane, but they have big shoulders on them. So they shove it all over the side, and then when it gets up, maybe taller than Lou or me, and they have this big monster thing that comes by with this big, I don't know what you would call it, on the front. It's like a snowblower from Mars or someplace. It takes all the snow on the shoulder, when you have no place else to push it, it like shoots it, what, maybe 500 feet down into the valley or someplace. And once in a while, they bump into like a small car in there, right? It's buried in the snow, and oops. Yeah. But to watch those things in action, then all of a sudden, the shoulders are perfectly clean, and the next snow, you got room to shove the stuff again. Otherwise, the road would be about an inch wide by February, right?
Yeah, part of the theory of road management here is that the snow's going to melt, you know, reasonably quickly. So we're going to be 60 degrees.
So on in Denver, not heading to the resorts.
Yeah, at Denver. Yeah. We're going to be at 60 degrees here in Denver on Sunday. So the assumption is we don't have to plow the streets and whatever. And it's one of my big gripes about just the overall ideological management of the city and to a great extent the state. There are people who just believe that cars are bad. And so they don't want to make it easy for people to drive. We don't build enough parking deliberately downtown. And we have this idiotic fixation on bicycles. Chicago had the same problem.
Oh yeah.
But we have this idiotic fixation on bicycles. And you know, I'm sorry. You can't bike here down on these roads, you know, probably 70% of the time during the winter, because if you don't plow the ice or the roads, you end up with big ice patches as the cars pound this stuff into the pavement, and nobody wants to take a bike on that stuff. My gripe for the get off my lawn, old man gripe for the day. I wanted to talk briefly about Ukraine and what seems to be happening.
Absolutely want to put that number one on our list. But do you mind commenting first on the conversation yesterday regarding the NIL stuff? Just part of it going down to high school, and I just, you know, whenever this kind of stuff happens, I have the same imagination on the economic side of things. And after going through the, you know, when deregulation in 1973 and so forth, and being in school when all that stuff was theorized and pushed and so forth, when this kind of stuff happens, it's as fascinating to me, Lou, as some of the legal stuff. And we definitely are going to get to Ukraine. That's the number one subject today. But it seems to me that we're liable to get this European model here where the colleges are kind of useless, and what people are going to offer at Notre Dame is somebody gets signed up in high school. I don't even know who signs the damn thing, the old man does or whatever, and they're signing up for a place, Michigan, where they get to go to school for 6 years, they get paid, they have this professional team where they're going to be taxed, and they're for people who want to play ball for 6 years, then go on and be a lawyer, or 7 years, and you're going to end up with, you can play as long as you're in school. Doesn't matter if it's going to be 5 years pretty soon, right? Then it's going to be six. Then it's going to be seven if you're a lawyer.
One of the topics that I identified was this lawsuit that's been filed in Georgia by this Georgia baseball player, so saying that this kid should be able to play as long as, basically extend his eligibility for all periods in which he was in a non-NC2A school. So in this case, junior college.
Right.
So,
he already won that, didn't he?
Well, no, this is a baseball player.
Okay.
The case that he's modeling it on is the kid from Vanderbilt, the quarterback,
okay,
Pavia.
Okay.
So, you know, Pavia plays 2 years at a junior college, and then comes in to 2 years at junior college, 2 years at New Mexico State, and a fifth year at Vanderbilt, and so that's he's now going to play another year this year, and you know, what are we doing here? How old are we going to have these guys playing, and are we just gonna make it so that if you're a student in good standing at the university, you can play college sports?
I don't see how that loses anywhere in any court.
Well, it doesn't, given the fact that they don't count non NCAA school time at foreign universities, for example. So, you know, they're arguing antitrust. So yeah, I think you're rapidly seeing a move to effectively turn all of these programs into professional sports programs. The House settlement of the antitrust case in California, there, I think the court's going to approve their NIL scheme in April, and that, as we've discussed here, that effectively turns the college NIL programs into an NFL salary cap kind of situation, where teams are going to be allocated a certain amount of NIL money up to a cap, and then they're going to have to allocate. They'll be allowed to allocate that money as they see fit, and that whole thing is going to be monitored by a separate entity. I assume the NCAA will have to set it up by a separate entity that will track salary or NIL cap money, who gets it, how much, when it was paid. That's going to further roil this situation. The Trump administration just removed a serious impediment to the whole thing by ruling that Title IX requirements for funding, which, you know, the Biden administration had in sort of classic, what I consider to be classic stupid fashion, had said that the NIL money had to be allocated equally between men and women sports, that Title IX applied to not just government money that was put into these programs, but sponsorship money under these circumstances. The Trump people just removed that interpretation. So now this program can move forward relatively unfettered. That is going to completely turn the college football playoffs and the rest of it on its head as this money, you know, pours into these schools, and it ain't going to be coming into these schools in equal tranches. These caps will apply to the major college.
All right, quick question: how the hell does a state legislature solve that has a that's going to last as long as a fart in a hurricane? How does a state legislature solve a salary cap for professional sports?
I don't know.
You know, I'm going to say that's a loser.
They're going to set this system up, and Illinois is going to be part of it. Colorado will be part of it.
Why does everybody think that nobody tries to be in control of bar owners or farmers or anything like that? Why do people think they have to be in control of sports? Why can't they? It's going to be professional. Why just let it be professional? And everybody's so locked in with a brain fart.
Because what's happened is there's so much money at stake here that you know, people are not going to let it sit and develop as a competitive league. The issue, the major sports leagues deal with this through their organized labor contracts. The colleges, these kids are not employees, although they're trying to move them in that direction, but these kids are not employees. There is so much money involved that they are, the players are staking a claim to it, and the marketplace, if you will, specifically the legal marketplace, is stepping in to fill this void in terms of how you classify these people and how this money, this tremendous amount of money that's coming in, is going to be allocated. As long as you maintain this amateur fiction, all of this stuff had to go under the table, and it did go under the table
for a little bit. Nothing like this. Nothing like this kind of money, though.
You know, Tom, I don't. When I was doing the agent thing, I used to think to myself, well, you know, this doesn't happen on an industrial scale. I was wrong. Every player that I talked to, you know, and I talked to dozens, obviously, over the years, was aware of payoffs. Every one of them received some kind of payoff. I don't know how much in terms of actual value or numbers, but I know that the payoffs were going to everybody, and it was going on for years. I mean, the classic case in point is that UCLA basketball dynasty.
Oh God, yeah.
Back in the 60s and 70s, those kids were getting paid.
What was your hero, Tark's wife, the one with the huge blonde hair? Tarkanian?
Well, at UNLV?
Yeah, but they were always getting spanked for something. And, yes. And the wife said something about it.
And, of course, and Tarkanian's position was, I'm not doing anything that anybody else isn't doing. I'm just being open about it, and I'm being honest about it.
Well, the wife said, that how come we're getting suspended or something when our guys are wearing leather jackets and the UCLA guys are wearing fur coats?
Right. Well, I mean, that's right. So all this stuff was going on under the table, but there was a regulatory scheme over the top of it that sort of kept it quiet. But now the cat's out of the bag. It kept it down too, I think. It may have. As I said, anybody that thinks that any of the major sports teams weren't getting paid, and I mean even programs like Duke, where Krzyzewski tried to keep a tight rein on what his players were doing, but they had that kid that got $100,000 worth of jewelry or something from a jeweler in New York in advance of his last year at school, and you know, Krzyzewski, the coaching staff didn't even know about it until the jeweler raised the issue of, hey, I'm owed big money for this, and you know, the university you know, turned around, tried to cooperate with the NCAA on the investigation. It fell apart because the NCAA really didn't want to, you know, push that button.
There were schools, I think, Lou, that pushed it, and I think players managed to get something, but I, you know, the difference is, I mean, Dave Casper was in my class at Notre Dame. Dave lived in a dorm. I actually was in class. I was in, like, three classes with the guy. He was always there. I mean, he wasn't driving any fancy car. I didn't see any jewelry. I mean, he was a Notre Dame T-shirt. He wore to class in blue jeans. I mean, there was no trappings of cash there. I mean, which isn't to say, and when they got hit by the NCAA that one year where they had to do something, I don't know, forfeit a game or two, it was the little kind of crap that used to happen back in those days where somebody's uncle
somebody
died.
Some coach bought a kid a hot dog.
No, but he bought him a train ticket back to his uncle's funeral or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that was the kind of, it was always this $100 here and $100. You got to wear a sport coat. Yeah, well, I can't afford a sport coat. Here's $100. Go to the clothing store and get a sport coat. I mean, that kind of crap.
Yep.
You know.
No, well, in any event, what's going to happen when this NIL system gets in place? I think you are going to see the talent scouts reaching down. There'll be more money for recruiting, more money for, you know, identifying potential, you know, recruits, and yeah, it's going to reach down, and I think your state legislatures are going to have to step in, and the high school, you know, every state has a high school athletic management league or governing body. Though they traditionally have you know, been sinecures for favored individuals who, you know, were coaching or whatever. That's going to get a lot more serious now, because you're going to have high school athletes getting payoffs at DMS.
Well, that's another question.
Sophomores in high school,
are they getting? Are people getting paid? That was a big question yesterday. But the overriding question here I have is, why do people like you and all my buddies from Notre Dame and all the people I talk to, we're so, in we, me too, we're so I use the term brainwashed by this cartel professional model that we're terrified of letting something actually just be competitive. That somehow somebody has to watch all this stuff, when in fact, people will end up getting paid what they're worth, given the money that's there. Why does somebody have to put a salary cap on this? Why does somebody, you don't have to put a salary cap on what accountants make or what lawyers make. Why can't something, be just a free market? I mean, it's...
Well, because sports is a little different in that you have to worry about the quality and you have to actually bolster the quality of your competition if you're going to have a competitive league. And in the legal world, for example, if you've got, a super firm that crushes, all others with its ability to represent people, nobody really cares. It's not a big deal.
It's actually more important to people than the football.
Well, in terms of the development and delivery of legal services. But in sports, if you've got one super team and everybody else is non-competitive, then you're not entertaining people.
But in Europe there's no rules on this of any kind. If a kid wants to play soccer, he plays soccer. It has nothing to do with Notre Dame or Michigan or Ohio State.
Well, if the kid in Europe, if they have this issue in Europe, then Europe, the product line is diverse enough that these teams, because of the national teams that recruit and pull people in, you have a sort of a dual track that kind of leavens out the competition. The idea here is that if you have one team that wins all the time, or one or two teams that win all the time, the quality of the competition goes down. The sport is not as entertaining, and people don't watch.
Well, that's interesting. Except it always comes down to who gets to guard the guards. I mean, I don't see any logic whatsoever in Lou Michaels going to Duke Law School. If you want to play football, play football. And if you're good enough and you want to get paid, get paid. But who has to have? Why does there have to be a Pontius Pilate on top of this?
Because we're talking about an entertainment mechanism that has to promote competitive games to be entertaining. So that means that you have to worry not just about the big teams that can pull revenue in. You have to worry about the competition so that they have somebody to play in a contest that people will watch.
Okay, but it's not. You're making a big. This is an interesting conversation, but we got to dump it for the Ukraine one. But that's more important. But it's again, you and I are splitting hairs here, but. Which end are you coming from? Are you coming from the end that you get to play football for Duke? That's your right. Somebody doesn't get to say.
I'm coming at it from the sort of the 40,000 foot.
I know. So level, I'm saying, but who level? Well, why should the law care how much money Duke makes? It should be about you. I mean, it's not. That's why I started this all out by saying
your labor.
We are inundated by. The professional model, which in my mind absolutely sucks. We start from Major League Baseball having an antitrust exemption. Well, that's not my model. And why do we have to force these guys into that?
The analysis that I'm familiar with, and this makes sense to me, is that you have to have competitive teams. If you allow pure market forces to dominate, you end up with a non-competitive league that people don't watch. That's the philosophy that drives this.
We've been doing that for how many games per year did Alabama play Jerry's kids? Every year?
Five? Not that many.
How many teams in the SEC in the last 15, now it's changed, you're right, about it's changed the last few years. How many teams had any chance of beating those guys?
Well, a number, because they would lose. And again, the idea, while the Alabama fans love the fact that their team is stomping on people, the great allure of college football is you've got new people coming in constantly, and these teams become competitive again.
But for decades, we had in the Big Ten for decades we had one game: Michigan and Ohio State. Michigan State once in a while pile in there before Penn State showed up.
Yeah, and I think that the NCAA looked around and said, we're trying to keep this competitive, so we limit scholarships and we limit other things to keep, you know, Alabama, Ohio State, Michigan from completely siphoning up every football player that, in the country that they can reach, and limiting everybody else's ability to get these kids. And that's, you know, I understand it. I don't like it, but I understand it. The professional model is designed to keep teams competitive, and I think the NFL is the master of this.
That's the alleged story. What really maintains their control in a lot of ways.
That's certainly if you're trying to maintain competitive balance, then somebody's, you know, this is the old equity part of diversity, inclusion, and equity. Equity is the forced distribution of equal outcomes, and that's what you're getting.
Well,
and that's what it looks like.
I'm saying that there doesn't, just because kids are getting paid, in my mind, doesn't mean that a state legislature has to hop in and become the salary arbiter. I mean, they're getting paid because it's an open game.
It's an interesting question as to whether they are willing to do that, but I'll defer as to how that's going to work out. Where I see that playing out in terms of legislative influence is at the high school level, and how that, you know, how that's going to be regulated, because that's, you know, there is no national high school organization to control this kind of stuff.
Last question before we switch to the more important topics. I was reading yesterday, and I had the names out here, but then I didn't use the names with Kevin. All these high school kids, now a lot of them, it appears, seem to have websites and a lot of
absolutely,
and essentially they're sponsoring the website for the kids. So, but if you actually sign the kid up and he's 17, what can you sign him? What does Red Bull think they're buying? And what does the kid think he's selling? And what is the dad who signs the thing if the kid's under 18? What does he do? As soon as the kid's 18, does the kid have to sign it himself? And can he say, well, it's interesting, my dad signed one, but I'm out, I'm going somewhere else. I mean, how's that all even working out?
So minors can be signed to agreements that will effectively control their performance or their work, at least with respect to certain. Well, I'm not phrasing this very well. Minors can be signed to agreements by their guardians that legally bind the minors to do certain things. Once the minor turns 18, they have to sign the contract themselves. They're presumed to be, in most states, presumed to be able to sign a contract. And so the contracts have to be re-signed. You are going to run into problems, and there have been, these have happened, where, you know, you've signed a contract with some kid who then turns around, or a guardian of some kid who then turns around and says, I'm not doing it. And is it enforceable? Well, the agreement is enforceable to the extent that if they've put money in there, that the guardian may be liable for paying the expenses incurred to date. But there's really no legal control over somebody who is incompetent to sign an agreement, and that's an issue. Now, you want to make yourself unemployable in the sports world as a 16-year-old repudiate a contract, and make people look at you as unreliable.
If you're 17 and Nike signs you up for Oregon, the old man signs it. To a certain extent, I'm not so sure I'd want to do that for my kid before anybody else. And all of a sudden, the day before the kid's 18, Under Armour swoops in from Notre Dame and says, screw that, here's an Under Armour contract that's born, we want you going to Notre Dame.
That could I could easily see that happening.
No, so we're in the Nike's just, oh well. Or are they going to do it to the next guy and it's back and forth, or what?
The contract... a miner can always repudiate a contract under those circumstances.
Well, can you?
And there may be, there are certain types of security, I suppose, that the miner, that the Nike could insist on, in terms of if you repudiate the contract, certain things are going to happen with respect to the person who's signing on your behalf. But yeah, you can, if you're legally incompetent to sign an agreement, you can't be held to the agreement.
If the Irish or Michigan or Ohio State, I keep using the Irish because obviously it's a tip of the tongue, they can't sign somebody up for 4 years and without the kid being able to go through the portal, can Nike require the kid, or Under Armour require the kid to go to Notre Dame 4 years or some other Under Armour school?
I don't see why not.
Well, it's kind of getting around the whole thing, isn't it?
It could, yes, but I don't see why. There may be some legal limitations on that. I mean in terms of what they can commit the kid to do, but in terms of honoring their contract and saying you've got to be at this school for us to pay you, I don't see why you couldn't say that.
What do you make of Rick Pitino's kind of comments that why recruit anymore? Sort of like too much. I mean, he didn't exactly say that, but close to it. Basically said, I'm losing guys through the portal, I'm going to grab guys through the portal. Why should I spend all this money sitting in parents' living room on a private jet talking to people I don't even like, saying how I want their kid when I can just go get them the next year?
Well, that's the Deion Sanders model. Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I'm absolutely convinced that the service academies are not long for Division One.
Well, maybe. All right. Ukraine. What?
Air Force is losing. Air Force is losing three of its starters this year to the
portal. How much? Well, I keep going back to this. It's so intriguing to me on the economic side, Lou. Not to mention, I like sports, so do you. I do think at some point, if Lou's going to law school at Duke and wants to play ball, you're going to play ball. Now, the NCAA is trying to get ahead of it by giving everybody a fifth year now, but what's the magic between 5 and 6 and 7? What's the difference? I mean, why do they get to say anything if you're in school? But that's another question. So far, Marquette, which is in Milwaukee, seems to be, I was listening to them the other night, and my buddy Bill Murphy, attorney friend, went to Marquette. I tell you what, his story was he went there on a football ride, and then they bleep canned the football team, and they said you can keep your scholarship if you box for us. He was a boxer. When did intercollegiate boxing stop? At like 60s somewhere, late 60s.
I mean, Air Force had all the service academies had active boxing programs. They didn't start fielding quote unquote intercollegiate teams until after I left. So, and I don't think intercollegiate boxing is a formal NC2A title sport.
I don't think it is either, but
it's like a club sport.
Anyway, but he's the announcers were talking about how Marquette, the football team, the guy's got that, what's that really wacky name the coach has, Shaka something something. He's a really good coach. And he's either not lost anybody to the portal yet or hasn't grabbed anybody from the portal yet. So, and then there's the Irish trying to keep going with we're so different, all these kids are going to school and this and that. Well, I think you can hold back the salmon run for a while, but at some point I don't see how you can do that, how you can be that much holier than the next guy. But I think there's a few holdouts, but I don't mean that to me. What's the cost of recruiting somebody?
Yeah, well, I mean, 50 grand or something. The service academies are going to lose, I think, are going to lose out big time on this, and because they will simply be recruiting grounds for people, and eventually, the people in charge are going to say we're not playing Division One football anymore, and we'll.
How many teams do you think we end up with? 60?
I think when we talked about this a couple of months ago, I think there's going to be a lot of pressure for this commercial 70-team league that will be sponsored by venture capital money, that will take all of the salary cap stuff off the hands of the athletic directors, will manage all the NIL money. Yeah, this is for college football. And set up a playoff system And you know, every now and then we'll play schools outside the 70-team league for you know, for visibility. But you know, I think there's a lot to say for setting up a venture capital based pro football team league for college teams outside the aegis of the NC2A.
Well, it's, you're not going to see me going to South Bend anymore if that's the team. I'm not going to, you know, I don't see the Bears. I don't want to see them.
Yeah. Yeah, well, because you'd see decent football.
Well, that's very possible. That's very
So
hey,
so
you see,
let's talk about Ukraine.
Well, give me, you know, you see that the Chicago, you've been out of here for a little bit, that the team decided to dump NBC. We used to be Sports Channel, then it became NBC Sports Channel, and go with the Chicago Sports. And so they dumped those guys. So it's the Sox, the Bulls, and the Hawks. Cubs have their own. And now, somehow or another, they still have not gotten a deal with Comcast. Their viewership is down 63% from last year, Lou. They're impossible to watch. They would have been down 30% no matter what, but 63 is a lot, isn't it?
Yes. We had a fight like that here in Denver with Altitude Sports, which was trying to control broadcast rights, local broadcast rights for the Avalanche, and they were dealing with the Crunkies, with the Avalanche and the Nuggets, and you couldn't get those games locally here. So I don't know. I mean, this is pure economics and pure market share. And what's your team worth in terms of watching? So non-competitive teams equals lower local sports revenue.
All right. Ukraine, we have all kinds of gamesmanship going on. I'm willing to give guy a chance, you know, to see. I think it's going to take a little gamesmanship to get some kind of solution there, to be honest with you. So.
What I find remarkable, and you know, I still am of the position that we need to support Ukraine. But I'm also of the position that I don't think from a both a practical and a moral perspective, it makes sense for us to fight to the last Ukrainian. And that's what's happening.
I would agree.
Their biggest limitation on what's going on right now on the ground, and they are losing on the ground. They're not losing a lot every day, but they're steadily losing ground because the Russians are importing combat help, and the Ukrainians are simply running out of people. And you know, we can put equipment in there as much as we want. The end result is going to be the same. The Russians will take that area if they are willing to continue to expend men and material in the way that they're doing it. So the question, and this is Trump has a number of, I think there's a number of motivations playing in for Trump that are driving the train. The first is that he considers war to be an insane waste of people, materials, and everything else, and that it's
bad.
Well,
he's not going to get any disagreement from anybody there, I hope.
No, and it's bad for business. It's bad. There is a constant armed standoff between nations is expensive and non-productive and problematic, and so from his, it offends his business sense that this conflict is going on.
It did Dan Corleone as well, remember?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it should. This is not intelligent. It's not intelligent to do this. Number one. Number two, he looks at Ukraine as this corrupt, and it is corrupt, sort of quasi-democratic sort of state that really doesn't deserve our support. And some of this goes back to the whole Biden crime family thing that was going on there, and his attempts to get information out of Ukraine relating to what Hunter Biden had done there, and what the strings Joe Biden pulled when he was vice president, and we now know that his Trump's accusations were on target. So he looks, he's not a fan of Ukraine as a sort of a general rule, as the kind of place that we should be promoting. You know, he sends his vice president over there to Europe to bash the Europeans over their failure to enforce basic human rights, which also affect U.S. companies going over there. And you know, then he looks at Ukraine and goes, yeah, you guys are 10 times worse than the EU in terms of repression and all that. Now, the Ukrainians are at war. I get it. When we were facing an existential threat, we repressed a few civil liberties ourselves in World War II. But the short answer is this is how he views the situation. And then finally, personally, you know, Zelensky came over here and campaigned with Democrats in, what was it, September. I mean, that was a bad move.
Do you think, without getting too much of a... I was listening to preamble of World War II, and I listened to Roosevelt speak probably 10 times on this two-hour-long thing. I never got the impression, when you listen to him, you get the idea that he was president of the entire country, even though he didn't get 100% of the votes. This guy does not act like that at all. From what I've been looking the last couple of days, and like I said, I want to give him a chance. Maybe his brand of the negotiation actually can do something here. I'm pulling for him 100%, obviously. You know, both of us loved our girl Angelica and what happened to her family over there, and the mother got here and all that stuff. I mean, it's a bleep storm over there. You just said it more eloquently than me. But the idea that, you know, that's a dictatorship, and yet Putin's guy just died in a jail because Putin murdered him, right? For whatever going on with the Biden administration, I never would have accused Roosevelt of having his hand in the till, like either one of the Biden. I mean, how much money does Trump owe Putin and his pals?
I mean, I don't think any.
They've been buds for. They bailed him out of the one place by the United Nations. I mean, what I'm saying is this is not a Roosevelt type transaction. These guys are tainted.
In some respect, it really is. I mean, Roosevelt dragged the country toward war in the late 1930s with Lend-Lease and the other things he was doing. He basically put the Japanese in an untenable situation when we shut down their ability to get oil. Roosevelt was dragging us in that direction. The country was quite isolationist, and Roosevelt said, "I've got a vision. I see this coming. We're going to get killed if we don't start."
He was also privy to information nobody else had.
Well, but it doesn't matter.
But right, you don't
think Trump's privy to information?
I'm giving the guy, I think his brand of negotiation might actually work here.
It very well could, but in terms of what he's doing as far as building national consensus, you know, I don't think he really he believes he's got a national consensus. He got elected.
If he certainly does to stop the war. I'm on his side 100%.
And so if he can, you know, his he looks at this and says, my vision of this is that this is stupid, it's wasteful, and we're gonna try to turn it off. Now, he understands the limitations, he understands the transactional nature of this. He's got one side to go, you know, one group of guys with nukes and lots of military and a clear willingness to go to the mat. And so the other side is just not as capable.
I believe he's sitting there going,
"I'm not going to back. I'm not going to. Why are we backing the loser here?"
I'm going to agree with you on this. I think that Zelensky, although I would take him over Putin, needs a slap. What they say, a cold slap in the face, to realize that this is not going to go on forever. It can't either by him or by us. You're 100% correct.
That's what Trump's tweet was the other day.
What do you think he wants to give?
But there's not, Tom. There's not going to be. I mean, this is a very non-ideological president who is looking at this conflict from a very, what I consider to be a realistic perspective, which is, unless we are prepared to put NATO troops on the ground in Ukraine and drive the Russians out of there, this war is over. You know, we're not, our job right now is to stop the killing, stop the, waste of people, stabilize that if we can through negotiation. And yeah, we understand that Putin's going to be coming back. So our job will be, in addition to stabilizing it, putting something in place as a buffer so that Putin understands that he can't do this in the Baltics
or in
Poland.
Let's assume and hope that he is two steps ahead of these two goofballs. And he could very well be. And what do you think the deal is? What does Russia get? How much? How much of the property?
I think they get what they've got right now.
Which is about how much? The part they got originally, I think they're going to get to keep that. How much more?
They'll keep Crimea, and probably.
Is there like a river there or something that?
No, they may have. We may try to get them to fall back beyond that. It's the Dnipro River, and maybe we tell them to stay on that side of it, and they'll have to do some of the stuff. But I mean, what else are they going to make them do? I would love to see them return those 300,000 children they've kidnapped, and return those people and pay. Some kind of reparation or whatever.
I mean, you know more about this than me, but I can't see some boundary other than geographic, like a river. I can't believe you're going to have a sign like going to Indiana, you're leaving Illinois, entering Indiana. I mean, I can't see that.
What I'm afraid we're going to end up with is something that looks very much like East and West. It looked like East and West Germany during the Cold War.
Like a big fence?
Yeah, a frontier. And some kind of circumstance where with sensors and minefields and everything else, so that we are aware, you know, if the Russians are going to try to, you know, make incursions and send their little green men across the border again, we are cognizant of it and are equipped to stop it. At the same time, we should be bolstering Finland and Sweden and the Baltics and basically setting up to, you know, turn off Kaliningrad, that area in the Baltic, and sort of preparing for war there. And this was part of the message to the Europeans that Vance delivered last week, which is, you guys, you know, you've got a bad guy sitting on your eastern border. Why are you not arming up? And
well, for years we didn't want him to. For years we didn't want him to.
Well, I'm sorry, this is not the 1980s, okay?
I know what I'm saying, but the idea that somewhere along the line this message would never have gotten out in the 70s, we didn't want anybody over there.
We have been sending this message since the late 1980s, and the Europeans have simply ignored it. The Germans, I don't know how many aircraft, operational fighter aircraft the Luftwaffe has right now, but 10 years ago the Luftwaffe had less than 70 operational fighter aircraft.
So they've
aircraft.
Got like less than Sweden.
And so, you know, Canada right now could be invaded by the Texas National Guard and not have enough equipment to stop, a state National Guard unit. That National Guard unit has more aircraft, helicopters, tanks, APCs, and combat troops. So this has got to get, you know, the UK has, you know, less than 200 main battle tanks. These kinds of numbers are just crazy.
Well,
so we've gone back to them and said, okay, we're going to watch as you guys fix this, because this is part of your issue.
Well, could you, you brought up something that I probably should know, but I don't. I think I realized the idea how Berlin was set apart with the wall and all that stuff. Then the movies like The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, where you see the crossings and guys walking halfway, the other guy walking halfway. But along the entire length of Germany, out in the middle of farm country, what did the border look like between east and west? I mean, was it Was there essentially a fence all the way through?
Yeah, there was a barbed wire. There were
for the whole length of the country?
The whole length of the country.
Wow.
It was a big, large barbed wire and mined zone that ran the length of the country.
That's why you had the few crossings, and that was it. I never put two and two together.
I was just over there. I was over there last year and started on the Elbe in eastern Germany, and then went all the way through Potsdam into Berlin, past Dresden and all this. And if as you go into those zones, you can see where the border zone was in some cases, where the trees that were cut down and the ground cleared. And of course in Berlin they maintain a line of bricks in the street where the Berlin Wall ran. But yeah, those zones were mined, they were surveilled, they were patrolled. And if you excuse me, if you got within, you know, the 500 meters or 1,000 meters of that thing, people were aware that you were there.
Well, so if I was going to go from Illinois to Indiana, I'd run into this barbed wire fence, is kind of no man's land for, what, 300, 400 yards, and then another spool of barbed wire, and I better not go in there because I'm going to blow myself up, basically.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, now, God. That was East Germany, because that's where we thought the fight was going to happen. In places like Hungary, where the border of Austria, there were border crossing points, but they were not nearly as heavily policed. And so when in the late 1980s, when things started to loosen up there, it was possible to make large scale crossings back and forth.
Plus it was more mountainous. You don't necessarily need a wall through the mountains.
Well, no, it's not mountains. It's rolling in flat farmland. But I was just over there last summer. And so if you read about the breakdown of the Iron Curtain, you know, there were, in advance of the Berlin Wall coming down, there were wholesale movements of people from Hungary into Austria and back and forth across that border a number of times before everything was formally recognized. And honestly, that's one of the reasons why you've got somebody like, you know, Viktor Orban, who is in power now. I mean, he was one of the guys that led that. You know, he talked the talk and walked the walk at considerable personal risk, and that's one of the reasons why he's popular.
But what
I think you're seeing play out with Ukraine is a very you can call it brutal if you want, brutal form of realpolitik, which is, you guys can't win. It's pointless for us to continue supporting the massacre of your troops and your people. Right now, your best bet is for us to stabilize the front, stop the fighting. We're not going to get that land back. We may not be able to get your children back, but to try to rebuild the country. And that's the deal. That's what we're offering you. And Zelensky, like a dipstick, you know, insulted Trump, and he had already insulted Trump once before, and I'm sorry. The president is not one of these guys that is going to just sort of let that go. And so he lashed out at
him. He's an insulter, not an insultee.
Well,
it's hard to be both.
I mean, he's, you know...
Is there a natural... I can't believe I'm even saying this. Is there a natural spot where, out of the 20 states of Ukraine, 4 are Russian-speaking and wouldn't mind being... I mean, if there is a heaven and there is a God, is there a spot where you could say these states go to Russia and these stay with Ukraine? Now, is Ukraine going to be able to arm themselves this world of Trump?
That's what they're going to negotiate towards, but the short answer is it doesn't matter. The Russians are in these places. I doubt if they'll get them to back up. And from the Russian perspective, their negotiation perspective is, this is now ours. We're going to take the rest of it at some point in the future, but this is now ours. We'll stop for now, so that we can rearm and re-equip, but you know, this is ours, and that's their mindset. So we have to come at this negotiation from that perspective, and say, if we're not prepared, again, realpolitik, are we going to invade Russia? Because that's what it's going to take.
Well, I get that in the short term, I have a real problem with this North Korea-Russian thing going on. I mean, I don't know what I can do about it if I'm president, but I got a real issue with that. I mean, that's on our side. That's so. Does that mean if Russia feels like rolling into Finland, they're gonna send me 100,000 guys from South Korea, and we'll just sit back here and do it? This sounds like the Hessians and the Germans.
That's what we have to deter, and that's what's a little tricky about this negotiation is we have to send a message to Russia saying, look, you got us here. We're not gonna drive you out, but if you come across the border anywhere else in a NATO deal, you're gonna get hammered, and you're not gonna get hammered by just, you know, the U.S. You're gonna get hammered by the Brits and the French and the Germans if we're gonna get them to snap out of it and understand that you are the enemy. I mean, for
heaven's
sake,
it's gonna be a tough conversation.
It is a tough conversation. Yeah. That's you know, Trump got laughed at in his first term when he was telling the Germans, you cannot keep buying Russian natural gas. You are making your economy dependent on Russia, on an enemy. Do you guys not get that?
And well, he was throwing both sides. He was also, Putin was going to be his buddy.
No, Putin was not going to be his buddy. Putin, he understood. I think he understands exactly who Putin is.
Right, well, I hope he does. I mean, you know, you said something earlier about, you know, the Roosevelt thing. I've heard that from all kinds of people that we somehow. Why would we want to sell Japan anything that made them a speck stronger after we saw what they did to China? Why would we think that it was only going to be China?
I'm just saying, Roosevelt's perspective was the Japanese were the enemy.
Well, he was right.
And what doesn't matter. That's not the point. The point is that the rest of the country was not there. I mean, you were talking about Trump not trying to build consensus. Roosevelt didn't try to build consensus. He maneuvered us into a position where we were going to be in a fight, and you know, began making those moves early after he saw what happened with Germany, and you know.
How's that any different than Germany now seeing the light and saying we got an enemy on both sides, we better start doing something about it? I mean, we had nothing in 1936.
Well, I would love to see the Germans pull their heads out and say, you know what? Okay, fine. 5% of our GDP goes to defense.
Did you I don't know if you bother to see the stuff I sent you. Those guys on YouTube, I don't know who's doing it, but it's absolutely fascinating. Especially if you don't mind the music, of all the different stuff from all the different countries and who's the biggest. I sent one yesterday to everybody about the biggest cap stock since like 1976. They just go to bars, keep going back and forth on the companies, and it's fascinating to see the movement. But there was one, I think I sent it. It had to do with people in the armed services or in the army in various countries. And it was absolutely fascinating that France, over like 200-300 years, almost had a stable-sized army. Peacetime war. Where we went from like a million or two World War One, we were up to God knows how many in the Civil War. Then we were down to like nobody. Then for World War One, we shot up again. Then we went from down to like 30,000, then up to like 3 million. I mean, we are up, down, all over the place. Where other places are.
Our culture. I mean, notwithstanding what we've had to do over the last, you know, 50 years, our culture traditionally has not been a big military culture because the military is not, for people in it, is not profitable. It detracts from business. It keeps you from actualizing your potential. I mean, culturally, that's been our thing. And so the military was not looked upon as a proper place for people to serve long term. You had the noblesse oblige that said you should go in and serve your country for a while, but then get out of there, do your thing, and get out. And that's been our history. And the idea that we would have a standing professional army is something that we were dragged kicking and screaming into in the 1950s and 1960s.
Yeah, pretty much. When you see this stuff happen over like decades, it is pretty amazing. Though I don't know how you split the baby here though, Lou. I mean, the thing that I always was impressed about Roosevelt is that he didn't trust the people around him necessarily, except maybe a couple, to give him the information he wanted. And even before the electronic age, he had all kinds of people, and that was basically the story of Winds of War, right? He had all kinds of people writing him letters from all around the world on what was going on that he pretty much didn't share with anybody.
So, well, the one guy that he really trusted, or the couple of guys that he really trusted, turned out to be Soviet agents.
Well, you're talking, well, how bad did the British get nailed by Kim Philby?
Oh, I know. But I'm talking about during the war with Hopkins and the rest of those guys.
Hopkins was a Soviet agent?
He was, that whole State Department thing was heavily influenced by the communists.
Oh, yeah. Well, but I'm saying, when you have, I don't know if you go on your Saturday TV show and start a radio show and start talking about what the Japanese did in China, and yet how can you sit there and say, oh, they only going to like, not like those guys. I mean, we really didn't want to give them the whole Pacific, did we?
No. And again, I'm just saying, my point is that Roosevelt was aware of this and projected this, and then said, okay, we're going to set our operations up so that we're going to end up at war with these people.
Well, I think from the original part, we were selling stuff. That's what got us out of the... It was actually a pretty good situation for him, because we upgraded our war machine kind of in 38 and 39 because we were selling stuff to the Brits and the French. So we were able to get rolling on somebody else's dime, which brought us out of the Depression pretty much, right?
Yes.
And if it wasn't for that, I mean, it's the one of the bigger, I don't know, I'll use the term, things not known in this country. Everybody's convinced that in December of 1941, we got this big wake-up call, and all of a sudden we started producing stuff. No. That didn't happen. You know, we laid down the 6 new battleships and went 38 or 39. The aircraft carriers, the Exeter class were already, these were all already rolling. There's no way we could have done that in 3 years, right?
No, I don't think so.
When did Marshall call the peacetime generals out of the Pentagon? Well, there wasn't even a Pentagon. In what, 37, 38? He was already starting.
Yeah, he was already started. They were already, well, they were watching what was happening in Germany.
Yeah,
I mean, I got to check off.
Hey, good stuff though, bud. And
see you next week.
So you're heading up to your cottage, your cabin, just to get warmer, or what?
Not this week. Maybe next week. Well, it's supposed to snow. It's supposed to snow here starting tonight and through tomorrow. And I don't want to be in the you don't want to be in the interstates around here when that starts happening.
All right, be safe, buddy. Yep. SP Futures down 17, NASDAQ Futures down 49. Greg, you want to go right to Wayne, or you want to have a quick break?
Hello, this is Tom Chief.
I guess that answers it. Are we going to break?
Going to break.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, Give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks,
Starks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howe, Greg Pappas on the board. We have S&P futures down almost 19. We have NASDAQ futures down 57. Big movers on the earnings point. Walmart down, even though they supposedly beat on something. They're down $8, which is almost 8%. That's a huge move for Walmart. These guys are 8 billion shares outstanding, so we're talking $64 billion in market cap. That's kind of a lot, Greg, in one morning. Also have Palantir down 530. Didn't they? What happened to him, Greg? There was some story yesterday between the...
Alex Karp was on CNBC, yeah. And he threw some shade towards Democrats. I'm not sure everybody liked that one.
But he also, there was something about the... cuts in the military. They are a big supplier to the military and so
oh,
else.
Yeah. They're the next Lockheed, in my opinion.
Yeah, they're anyway. They've got issues there. We have
not really though. I mean, they've gone up so much in the past month and a half.
Well, let's, you know, we have a position in there from an old earnings play. So actually, if it goes down, we might save the thing. It sort of happens. What have you been? Next week we might have a guest from one of the most. I'm going to say one of the longer-term quant people. Anybody ever heard the name Blair Hall? Blair Hall was a trader on the floor for a long time in the OEX pit with me, actually. But he went on to become...
a politician.
Well, yeah, he ran against... well, he was going to run for governor, and he ended up losing to... he was running for senator against Barack Obama, wasn't he, or something?
Yep. Kind of ran into a buzzsaw on that one.
Yeah. Well, he was kind of the leader early, but then all of a sudden he wasn't. But interesting guy. But he's always been on the real high end of I suppose we should
market start. Making.
It will start. Well, we'll start the story at the beginning. He also took the SIBO down one day. Do you know that?
Whoops. No, I didn't know that. But yeah. I can imagine that.
Well, there always was a. To show you how
you guys were like a pirate ship for a long time.
But we were I use the term a just pirate ship, for lack of how stupid is that? In other words, we didn't even have, when I say we, the market makers on the floor, everybody was very concerned, since the options were a new product, that we would ever be, we, the exchange, the option traders, and the product itself would ever be considered something sort of crooked. And there were always rumors about the Board of Trade floor, people could front run there. It was always the idea that the New York Stock Exchange was SEC light, that the SEC could never spank the Stock Exchange specialists. They were more powerful than the SEC, which, to a very large extent, I think was true.
Still are.
And there's no real specialists anymore, but the big firms still are. They're above the law, in a lot of people's opinions. So the Options Exchange really wanted to be Lily White because they were – They got into business. I mean, they basically forced their way into business, the Chicago Board Options Exchange. And they were, what happens when you get the, when you start?
It's a little help from us.
No, well, sure. But the Board of Trade were different animals. You know, they had competing, always had competing pits, those kinds of things. But when we were, what do you call when you give somebody a tentative approval? CBOE, we got a tentative approval, like to open up, conditional approval. And I think it was like, I don't know, it was 5 or 6 years before they removed like the conditional or whatever the word was from the approval. Yeah, which okay,
nice little trial period.
Yeah,
for
nice little trial period, whatever it was. So we were very concerned. The point, I mean, this is going to sound really stupid to people. They didn't allow CNBC when it first came on to be on the trading floor.
Right,
and you could not, if there would have been a cell phone, you could never have had one in the pit. In the pits, the market makers could not call into the pit directly for fear people would be front-running stuff.
I know that when the cell phone came out in 86 or whatever, that was big because you could call your broker from the golf course.
Call your broker. You couldn't call the floor. Yeah. I couldn't pick up the phone.
Right.
After a long period of time on the new floor, you could call in and ask for the extension, and I could call out from the pit. Because then we could have CNBC. The only news tape you had when I first started in 81, we were up in the balcony of the old Board of Trade floor, which is the new SIBO floor, which is even crazy. Hey, Wayne, you with us?
I am with you. I was looking at my inbox, but perhaps the internet is clogged up this morning.
Well, could be. We're just giving bear with us for a second. We're kind of in the middle of a CBOE story and how it's at some point, you know, people, you're always concerned, well, as time went by, you had stuff trading over at the S&Ps, and we had ways of dealing with S&P. The S&P futures, S&P 500 futures trade over at the Merck. So, okay, you couldn't have direct communications, but we had people on headsets that were the spoo guys, and they would constantly use their hand signals to flash what the real market was over at the Merck. And you probably privy to this, Wayne, but when you talk about a price, I mean, I used to give, you know, whole kinds of lectures. And if IBM is, 150 and an eighth to 150 and three eighths last trade a quarter, I'd say to people, well, what's the price? And they go, well, 150 and a quarter. And I go, no, it's not. Well, what do you mean? Well, it's traded 150 and a quarter. I said, that's ancient history. Your price, your buy price is 150 and three eighths, and your sell price is 150 and an eighth. You got to get that through your head. You're pricing your options. It's not a quarter. That's what somebody else just did. It's not what you can do. So all this kind of stuff, and what Blair Hull did was put together, and then you got so many stocks. Well, we only had 100 when I started. So many stocks that nobody could change the quotations manually fast enough. So there was all these various auto quote systems. And so Blair Hull had one of the best auto quote systems. But the problem with it, Wayne, is it's the CBOE. When I first started, the always was how many contracts can we clear a day? It was always in the determination of the capacity of the exchange was how many contracts could trade. Well, after a period of time, that wasn't the problem. The problem was how many quotes can we put out over the lines and can our equipment handle? You start talking about zillions of quotes, literally. Well, what Blair Hull did, when they said, okay, you can use your auto quote system. In any pit, there might have been 500 quotes, right, or 1,000 quotes of all the different stocks. Say there's 1,000. Well, the CBOE auto quote had a governor on it, where if you looked at, say, the IBM 60 calls or something, they'd be an eighth a quarter. Well, if the new quote was an eighth a quarter, it would look first and see it was the same number, and they wouldn't change it. So the traffic wasn't that light. The traffic only the quotes that needed to change changed. So Blair puts his system in there and doesn't have the governor. All of a sudden, every half a second, they're changing like 1,000 quotes. Change it all. I mean, if they're an eighth a quarter, they'd flash off and flash back on an eighth a quarter. The whole SIBO system went down, and they had no idea why for like an hour. The whole place, so all the stuff's being done on the Amex and God knows where else. And so finally, they turned off Blair's system, and the thing came flying back on again. So they wouldn't let him turn it back on until he got a governor and a thing. Anyway, ancient story, because I think we're going to have, he now has a new group doing a real lot of quant work, And one of the guys called me from, he said he was on the show 13 years ago. Anyway, they have a lady who now runs it. I've read her resume. She seems brilliant. She wants to come on next week and talk about some of this stuff. And Greg is going to be here with us. And it's, I think it's going to be fascinating. What do you think, Greg? I mean,
yeah, it should be interesting.
Because they tie together all kinds of different pieces of information, not only the markets, from outside the markets. From all
Goldman
the,
Sachs ended up buying that.
Yeah.
The evolution of that system that you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's good
they,
stuff.
They wanted it for themselves rather than let or him operate independently.
Yeah, I mean, it's a anyway, it should be very good. So, Wayne, all kinds of stuff is going on. Just was talking to Lou about, you know, what's going on in the Ukraine and Russia, and part of me thinks that, I'm not normally a big Trump fan, but part of me thinks that his particular brand of gamesmanship might actually be what's needed here with those two guys. Is that, am I pissing up a rope here, or might be something?
Well, I think looking back in Trump's first administration, how long was it before he had Sergey Lavrov and the Russian ambassador Kislyak in the Oval Office? He hadn't welcomed any other ally to the Oval Office, but those two were the first two to waltz in. Looking at Trump's history, I believe he is a Russian intelligence asset, and I believe he's been one since 1978 when he married Ivana Trump, the Czechoslovak wannabe Olympic skier who managed to get out of Czechoslovakia as a aspirant Olympic skier, winds up in Vienna, meets a real Olympic skier and marries him, and then winds up in Canada. And it's not too long before she's hanging around Donald Trump. And after that, it's not long before her and Donald Trump are seen photographed standing in Red Square right in front of St. Basil's Cathedral and the Kremlin.
Well, I don't know much of that. But what this guy in charge of the Ukraine, I mean, Lou thinks it's absolutely a game changer, these guys, North Korea guys coming in there. Because now all of a sudden he thinks, you know, Zelensky, he can't win. I mean, in terms of, I don't mean, what do you think their situation is?
Well, I think their situation is going to become more dire, although I do see that the European nations are stepping up, including Britain. One of the outcomes of this is this may be... this may result in the UK coming back into the European Union through a backdoor agreement. The current British Prime Minister is pro-European Union. He has a very comfortable majority in Parliament. And I think what we're going to see is Europe unifying, because now they see two threats. When I say Europe, I think there's also a possibility that Canada may come in some way into a maybe associate status with the European Union, and that wouldn't be any sort of oddity, because you've got the French culture in Quebec. And excuse me, you still have a Canada's head of state is King Charles III.
Yeah. Well, when you say the European Union, they're still essentially part of the old common market, right? Britain.
Yeah.
They never really had the currency, so for them to be an ally and part of, you know, the common defense thing, they wouldn't really have to rejoin the Union again to do that. They always were in that, right?
Right. There is a European defense grouping. Mostly it's France and Germany, but also Poland is now playing a very big part. Excuse me. I seem to have gotten a tickle in my throat.
Just relax. It'll go away.
but Poland is now playing a very big role in that. Now, with Marco Rubio meeting Lavrov in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, people noticed that the statement that came out of there where the U.S. is looking at cooperation with Russia, it was likened to the meeting between Joachim von Ribbentrop and Soviet Foreign Minister Molotov, where they announced the German-Soviet Pact of Non-Aggression, and about 2 weeks later they invaded Poland and divided the country between them.
Well, I'll talk for a minute while you clean that all that up. I'm a little concerned with the the North Korea sort of thing. The places that obviously should be the most concerned are Finland and Poland and whatever. But do you have a sense, before we talk about what's going to happen in the future, do you have a sense? Lou sent out a bunch of stuff a while ago of just how messed up Russia was getting, how their trains, which is really important there, they don't have roller bearings. And how they don't have enough. A lot of times they don't even have access roads where if cars break down, they can't even get them off the main line and stuff. And it's a big deal. And how the infrastructure was really kind of falling apart. Has the North Korean situation given them people? How much has that helped, and how much is it just the Ukrainians are falling apart even more, and they don't have as many people as the Russian people? I mean, what is your assessment of where everything is right now?
Well, I think Russia is having some severe issues. We now see reports that some of the North Koreans are defecting to the Ukrainian side. Racially, there's bad race relations between ethnic Russians and people from Asia, and that includes a lot of citizens of the Russian Federation in Siberia who are of Mongol and Chinese descent. So we see a lot of internal fracturing in Russia, and I think unless we see the United States strong-arming other countries into letting up on their sanctions and boycotts of Russia, I think Russia is in for a rough future. They've had 800,000 casualties in Ukraine. Now, Ukraine has had many too, but that's astounding. They have a huge drug problem with veterans from Ukraine. They've got ethnic and linguistic and religious fracturing inside Russia. So if Trump is putting his hopes on Russia being some partner in the future, I think he's barking up the wrong tree.
Well, what
China on the other hand is a different. That's a different story.
Well, I've had this feeling for a while, and again, my news is less than what you and Lou get, but I got this feeling in a while, but considering the two people involved, meaning Putin and Zelensky, the solution, for lack of a better term, sort of has to come from outside. The chances of those two guys ever getting together with a body left, coming up with any kind of a ceasefire sort of deal, I've felt has been pretty much non-existent for a long time. That somehow somebody has to, I don't know, does somebody knock a couple of heads together? And maybe Trump is, I mean, I'm hoping here, maybe his brand of New York negotiation might actually cause something to happen that those two would never be able to do on their own. I mean, I guess I can hope.
Well, I think the big problem is Putin has, really nobody wants to deal with a guy who's a murderer, he's a dictator, Zelensky, Trump, for example. Trump put out the on his Truth Social that Zelensky is only 4% popularity in the polls. He's 52%, and he's polling higher in Ukraine than Trump is right now in the United States. So, I mean, the idea that Zelensky is unpopular with the Ukrainian people, that comes right out of Moscow's propaganda mill. And I think the only negotiating partner I see is possibly the European Union, because there will be no settlement in Ukraine unless the European Union agrees to it. And because in the European Union you have all those countries now that are Russia may threaten in the future. The Baltic countries, Poland, Romania, Orban in Hungary, he's it's hard to say what he's doing because he's a dictator in his own right. But this body blow to NATO that Trump has delivered to this organization, which now is 32 members, it's the largest it's ever been. I think what we're going to see is a NATO 2.0 minus the United States, but including many of the current neutral nations in Europe, Switzerland, Austria, Ireland, and Canada. And I believe what we're going to see is Australia, New Zealand, and perhaps Japan, South Korea come into this new anti-totalitarian military alliance that will not include the United States, because now in twice the United States has elected somebody who has more vicious words about NATO than he does about Russia or China.
What just in terms of logistics here, what the is there a European who essentially runs NATO? What does the organization look like? I mean, I don't even know that. I bet most people don't. And who runs NATO?
Well, it's headquartered in Brussels. The supreme NATO commander, by tradition, is an American. But if Trump starts to pull the U.S. away from NATO, that role could easily go to a Brit or a German or somebody from France. NATO is pretty much a consensus organization. The NATO Council has to generally agree before taking any military action. And also in invoking Article 5, which says an attack on one member is an attack on all. Now, that's only been invoked one time. It was invoked back in 2001 by the United States, and all of NATO came and provided military troops assistance in Afghanistan and elsewhere. But I do think there's going to be an attempt either by the European Union's defense alliance or NATO 2.0 without the United States. I think they'll bring Ukraine in as a full member. And so Ukraine's currently is protected by the U.S. nuclear umbrella. It's sort of like, well, Russia, if you do anything to them or attack NATO, you got to deal with us. But a lot of people forget that nuclear umbrella can also be extended over NATO and Ukraine by two nuclear armed countries in Europe, and that's France and the United Kingdom.
Wayne, we're going to go to break here, but I know some people from Ukraine. Maybe there's a couple people that I know from the exchanges, and obviously Angelique at least helped produce the show. Every one of them, and it's a small sample, I get it. Every one of them was. Even though they're generally a Zelensky supporter, really thought him suspending elections was a bad idea. We didn't do that in the Civil War. We didn't do that in World War II. It gives the ruler some legitimacy. And if he'd have had those elections, he wouldn't have had to put up with Trump saying he's a dictator because he canceled elections. And he should have had the elections, I think. I mean, because I heard that from them. That wasn't me.
Again, it's probably hard to hold elections where you have people standing in line at polling places that could also serve as targets for Russian missiles to kill more Ukrainians.
Well, I mean, I'm saying we managed. I mean, granted, we weren't under attack, but it would have legitimized, I think, more. I mean, like I said, the Ukrainian people told me that he should not have canceled the elections. And anyway, he said he would have won, but all of a sudden he would have.
And perhaps he may, with this pressure coming on him from the U.S. side, perhaps he will take another look at that and try to do something.
Well, let's go to break here. We missed our first one. When S&P futures down 18, NASDAQ futures down 57. Major culprit is Walmart, down $8. That's almost 8%. That's a big chunk with the many shares they have outstanding. I'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI ProDirect. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI ProDirect can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI ProDirect. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Hear ye, hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control!
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right
now. Lone Wolf Base, Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Greg Pappas on the board. S&P futures down 18. NASDAQ futures down 54. Dow futures down 141. A lot of that is Walmart. It's down. Well, it's only down 775. Down. It was almost down almost 9. So it's coming back some. Remember the multiplier in a Dow, Greg? Was it about 680 or something? So if a stock's down a $1, that's almost $7 in the Dow. So Walmart being down, say, call it 8, is 50 some points in the Dow. So you got to remember the multiplier getting wild now with all these stocks that are in there, bigger size stocks. Over in Europe, DAX up 56.2%, FTSE down 33.4%, CAC around up 23.3%. Over in Asia, with the Nikkei down 486, that's 1.25%. That's a lot. They're saying Asia markets down as Trump tariff threats potentially higher for longer U.S. rates dent sentiment. Who knows if that's really the truth. Hang Seng down 367, 1.6. Shanghai down 76. What we do know is that the Nikkei and the Hang Seng are down. Bonds down 2 basis points. When I say bonds, 10-year rate, 4.51. The Bund unchanged, 2.55. Japan up another 2 basis points, 1.46. Oil continuing to sneak up here just a little bit, up 22 cents, 72.47. Still kind of mired in that low 70 number. Brent up 26 cents, 76.30. Natural gas down 14 cents, 4.13. Over $4, though. I think this cold spell has been pretty good for people selling natural gas. RBOB unchanged, 209. Gold up again, $24, 29.61, almost back to the, well, actually did hit record high. Silver up 58 cents, 33.62. Copper up 6 cents, 4.62. Foreign exchange, we've got the dollar pretty much unchanged, 104.5 with the euro, and 126, a little over 126 in the British pound. Crypto, Bitcoin's up at $1,100, 97,401. Greg, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. Dub Bulls down 63% in their TV ratings.
Whoops. Yeah.
I think part of that's they're not on Comcast, though, right? I guess that's part of
NBA
the deal.
NBA thing, league-wide, too.
Yeah.
Here in Chicago, we've got, 4 degrees right now, high of 22 today. Partly sunny most of the day, very cold. yeah, high of 22. Phoenix, 53 now, high of 80. Nice with sunshine there. Traffic, inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 30 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook, 45 minutes, getting worse. Eisenhower from Wolf is 44 minutes. Dan Ryan from 95th is 30 minutes. And inbound Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 40 minutes. Bulls play tonight at Knicks. That's 6:30. Phoenix plays in San Antonio. That's 8:30. And the big story tonight for is NHL. Canada at USA. Face off 7 p.m. Central. We've got USA favored by 1.5. Then the total is 5.5. So if you recall, the last time they played, that was the one where Canada ended up booing the U.S. national anthem, and the Kachuk brothers started the fights within 5 seconds of the puck drop. So, should be interesting.
Didn't one
tonight.
Of them start before the puck even went down?
Yeah, they were after they were. I think they were ticked about the national anthem, and they went after it from the beginning. So,
I still think that's one of the world's greatest hockey names, Kachuk.
Yeah, they were not. They were clearly angry, and then.
Where are those guys from?
Their all-star dad.
No, I'm talking about where from Wisconsin or Minnesota or where?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, they must be from the U.S. or playing for us, not Canada.
Right, but they definitely were.
Those two guys are awful good.
Peeved, yeah. I think they. They might have even more tonight. They might have a target on their back tonight.
Oh, God. So. Well, but plus, if you get those guys out, they score all the goals.
If they make it, you know, they're going to have... everybody's going to be fired up. I think they're playing in Boston this time, so...
Well, I'm planning on watching it, for sure.
Yeah. Kachuk was... What was he? He was in the league for, like, 20 years.
The old man, yeah. He's been around forever. He was a. What, where did he play? He wasn't playing. He didn't play in Boston, did he? Where did
he was famous on the Blues.
Okay.
So, Jets, Coyotes, Blues, and then the Thrashers too.
God. All right. Well, back Wayne. What? How capable is we as we toss out these economic numbers and you know you were on the show years ago and now as well. The thin thread through the whole show is that pretty much everything depends on everything else. Unlike. I mean, we try and look at not just read two stories. We try and the connections between the stories. Economically, how capable, in terms of both industry and money, is the European Union, and what's the time frame for them to, if they decide, like Trump wants them to and other stuff, you know, to ramp up? And what did Lou say? Britain's down to how many battle tanks? I mean, if they want to ramp up, do they have the industry? Do they have the capability? Do they have the drive? How does it? I mean, what condition is their nuclear arsenal in? Does anyone even know?
I think the I would bet that the French nuclear arsenal is probably better prepared than the Brits. Apparently, one of the outcomes of the British Tories having control. For so long is that the state of the British military isn't quite on the up and up right now, and I did notice, you know, I very very rarely do I follow stock prices because I'm in the politics and international relations, but I noted that after Trump's comments on NATO and Vance's comments and Hegseth's comments, all the European defense stocks went up in value. This is Rheinmetall in Germany, Airbus, which is an EU, it's a joint EU company, and a few other European Thales, the French, the big French concern, went up. On the other hand, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, and Raytheon, and U.S. stocks went down. So that may be the Europeans saying, look, we can't depend on the U.S. You know, Europe ordered a bunch of F-35s to modernize their air force, and then Elon Musk came out and said he's going to cancel the F-35. By the way, I don't know what authority has to do anything like that, but he said He said, I'm going to make sure the Marines don't use the F-35 and they use the A-10 instead, because Elon Musk is such a military expert, as we know.
A-10 just got out of production. The Warthog?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Elon, here we got it. We've got a South African ketamine, basically a drug addict, believing he's an expert on everything. Now, in cahoots with a guy who also thinks he's an expert in everything, but is a failed talk show.
By the way, Wayne, anybody who's very successful at any one thing, like doctors or traders or anybody, immediately think they're successful at everything. He's not alone in that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a human trait.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're amazingly rich because you're a chemist, you just assume you know everything about automobiles, which you don't necessarily, right? But I guess if just in terms of capability, I mean, I know the Swedish still make fighter jets, right? The Swedes.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, if Britain decides we need 3 submarines, who the hell's going to make them? Is it? I mean, the Australians make some, right? But if you're going to get a nuclear one, who can you use besides GE? How does this stuff even? I mean, if they decide to do something, how many years away
yeah.
are you? I mean, it's an aircraft carrier is a decade. I mean, and who the hell
yeah,
can?
I think this. The U.S. having command of NATO ever since its foundation, 1949, has led some Europeans into sort of this idea. Well, we don't have to worry about our defense. We got Washington to come in and do it. And I think there was a comment just yesterday, I think, by one of the defense ministers from one of the Baltic nations, it might have been Estonia, that said, look, all of our talking shops and stuff are over. Now we have to start doing. We got to prepare ourselves to defend ourselves. And the coffee receptions at the conferences is over. Let's now start doing something. So I think we're going to see a huge mindset change taking place in Europe.
Well, Wayne, whenever, we have, I won't say younger, but people that I talk to, most of them are younger, and I'll say, yeah, we got to get these European guys to start doing some stuff. What the hell? We're doing everything. You know, Trump's right. Do they need to start spending more and more? I said, careful with that, because for really 60 years, the last thing we wanted is Germany to have some huge army on their own. We just fought 2 wars over there. We didn't want that. We wanted to be in charge. I mean, I think I'm right, am I? I mean, we didn't want Japan with some massive army and navy.
Absolutely, and now you've got people in Germany looking at maybe Germany has to develop its own nuclear arsenal. Japan is an odd situation for years because they were the, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They don't want anything to do with atomic weapons, but they are probably the closest. They have what's called a short turnkey shelf to warhead capability. They don't have a working nuke, but over the years, that delta between the shelf and deployment has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller in terms of time. I understand now it's 18 hours before Japan would be able to have a deployable nuclear weapon on a missile or a bomber.
Well, the younger people that are running the world now, I think you need to have some recollection of this history. I mean, you can't go forward just because of your knowledge of history. But I mean, before you excoriate the Germans for not having 55 divisions and 90 billion battle tanks more than we have, the last thing we wanted was that. Right.
Oh, right. And but now we see this big German defense company, Rheinmetall. They're now gearing up to provide Ukraine with a lot of weaponry that may cease from the United States. You know, Rheinmetall is considered such a threat. Vladimir Putin attempted to assassinate the company's CEO.
What do they make? What do they make?
Oh, they make they make tanks. They make artillery. Mostly for land land battles, but Ukraine, that's basically a land battle.
Now, when you say tanks, would you have any guess on how big they are and how many they pop out a year?
It's the German Leopard tanks. I would say they're probably in the neighborhood of the M1 Abrams tanks, but a lot more sophisticated as far as fire control and computerization and things like that.
So they're better.
Yeah. Oh yeah, much better, much newer.
And we don't really have a new tank. Of course, some people think maybe tanks are obsolete. I don't know if they are or they aren't, but I guess they aren't if you're interested.
Yeah, and of course they also make these. Rheinmetall also makes these mobile command and control vehicles, which may have offensive capabilities in terms of controlling drones, for example. And we see a lot of drone use right now in the Ukrainian-Russian war.
Well, you know, in defense of, you probably guess, I'm not a massive Musk guy, but in defense of Musk, I have always, in my opinion, and again, we've got people under Mike Murphy comes on, and Lou for sure, these guys have, been in the military, they know their stuff way more than me. But I have really been against, for a long time, with my little bit of knowledge, I don't want, if I had a choice between 16 aircraft carriers, 75% as big as the ones we have, versus 10 that only a third of which can be out there at any given time because of the constant redoing for those things, I'd much rather take the 16. I mean, I would much rather. Now it looks like if China can sink three of them, we got nothing, and there's not like kind of nothing behind. I'd much rather have, for land-based stuff. I wouldn't mind. I'd much rather have 100 Warthogs and two F-35s. I mean, it seems like our generals over the last 20, 30, 40 years have really gone with less and less stuff that's higher and higher priced and more sophisticated. I mean, instead of having, 500 bombers, we've got 30. I'm sure they're for a short war, you're way better off because they're way more sophisticated. But as time goes by, if we ever fought somebody for like 3 years, I think we'd have a problem because we'd run out of these things. Even if they didn't get shot down, they'd fall apart on their own. So I don't really like. It wouldn't surprise me at all that a guy like Musk, if there isn't a guy like Musk, would walk in and say, What is your motivation for this? Where everything we have costs a fortune. By the way, we don't have very many of them. I don't know if that's his. But if he says that, I'm with him 100%. I don't like where we've headed in the last 30 years. I mean, do you think I'm nuts or what?
No. Well, what I think Musk is trying to do is he is also a defense contractor. So we get into this conflict.
Oh yeah, there's always a conflict with these guys. That's the truth.
So he doesn't like Lockheed Martin. He doesn't like the F-35. You know, he probably has something up his sleeve. They found in a State Department budget, they wanted to buy 600 cyber trucks and armor them for State Department use and embassy security. I mean, I've seen these cyber trucks. They look like they're made out of plastic, and they fall apart.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't like the conflict. But, I mean, there's some very legitimate questions as to, if you're talking about which would you rather have in a protracted war, 100 F-16s or 5 F-35s? I mean, I know what I'd rather have.
Well, if I were Elon Musk, I'd be worrying about people with pitchforks and shotguns right now because I had a knock on my door the other day from a neighbor. He said, hey, listen, you were up in Washington for a while. my Social Security check got cut over $300. Lady across the street from me, she did too. Lady around the corner, her Social Security got cut. And I said, wait a minute. I'm trying to figure all this out. I said, look, I know they're taking more out of Medicare, but not that much. And I said, when did you retire? He said, in 2001. I said, wait a minute, you're not that old. It turns out what they cut is the SSDI, and it looks like they lost all of it because they either were injured on the job and were getting Social Security disability, which comes out of a different pot.
Right.
The money, I understand. And so they've now asked me, you know, what can we do? I said, if you call your congressman, we got a guy here, he's a former car salesman, Republican. And he said, yeah, they're not answering their phone. And I said, well, look, you guys get together, find a day, and what we'll do is have a caravan. We'll go down to his local office, we'll go in there, and we'll just take your lawn chairs, and we're not going to leave until we get to talk to the congressman on the telephone. And, you know, that's how revolutions start.
Well, you know, do you want... I remember reading this a while ago, not when we first started the show, but maybe... You probably know the guy. He was a Washington Post reporter, and he wrote a... I think either won a Pulitzer Prize or he was up for it. It was probably a several article, you know, four-page thing in the paper back when they still did that. And I forget what the title of it was, but essentially he dealt with what he called the Horseshoe of Despair. You know the article I'm talking about?
I don't recall that.
Where he started essentially in West Virginia and went south around and then snuck over the river and back up towards like Missouri and Arkansas, which looks like a horseshoe.
Yeah.
And he talked about the mid part of the country, how messed up it was. And And he went through West Virginia. And he was talking about there were you know, two and three family trailers kind of yoked together, and there's five and six checks going in there of various stuff, and a couple of the kids supposedly had autism, but they refused to ever let the kids get checked out where they really did or didn't. And anyway, yeah. they made it down to a county in Alabama where so many people were on this long-term disability, Social Security, which forever, when you talk about Social Security, there's four pots, right? There's the retirement pot that everybody knows about. There's the aid to dependent children, right, which not many people, unless your old man dies, know about. There's a long-term disability, and the other one is what, a burial benefit or something? Is the fourth?
Right.
There's like four. Mm-hmm. Well, everybody always worries about the retirement piece. And the other three were always flush, right? They never had a problem with funding. Well, now it turns out that this disability part is essentially becoming long-term unemployment in a lot of areas. But then the guy, as he explained in this article, there's this article in a county in Alabama where one doctor was essentially saying all these people deserve long-term disability. And, you know, if you're a guy that comes in from the top and don't read the fine print, and I'm going to use his name, but I never met him, I don't want to accuse him that bad, but if you don't know the people, you know, it's like, you know, Trump's old man throwing people out of rent-controlled buildings. You don't know the people, you have a different view of the world. I mean, but the guy went into the detail in interviewing a couple of women that are on this long-term disability, and they were in their 50s. Well, they started working in nursing homes and hospitals when they were like 18.
Yeah.
And they've been hauling people out of bed before they had those things. Now, you ever seen them? If somebody's in bed, can't really get out, especially if he's a big person, they bring this thing over and the machine essentially pulls the person out up to an upright position. Mm-hmm. The person doesn't have to do it. It's a pretty interesting invention. But she says, I've been hauling people out of bed for essentially 35 years and my back is shot. And she goes, and you talk about, you know, people, I'm sure sitting on my dead ass doing the show, right? And I'll be doing it all day managing money for people. But she goes, I don't know a person that has a job where they sit down. She goes, everybody that is doing what I'm doing for 35 years has a back where I can't do it anymore. So I'm disabled for this job. She goes, if you gave me something else where I did billing for people all day long, I'd go to work tomorrow. But there isn't one. She goes, but I'm disabled for what I do. And I never thought of that until I read this. But she's saying, in those kinds of areas where people always work essentially blue collar with their hand, they can be disabled But if you shifted them somewhere and said, okay, we're going to retrain you, even to do computer work, you could probably do it. But there isn't any of that going on.
There's no jobs in those places.
No.
You drive through these. They're all deep red states, too. I drove through some of these places in South Carolina. The downtown area looks like a bomb hit it. Or it was subject to a zombie attack. You know, the buildings are there. The people are gone. The businesses are gone. So it, you know, SSDI may be a form of that type of long-term unemployment. But the people where I live, they may get a small pension. Most of them are widows whose husbands died. They're probably getting something from their husband's pension. They're basically living on Social Security.
Yeah, yeah.
Including SSDI.
Well, with all the money problems in Europe, their markets are all up because, well, in my opinion, we poured so much money in the system, the markets keep going up, even though people aren't doing as well as maybe people think they are. Is Europe capable of all of a sudden, say, instead of, you know, $100 million, we're going to spend $12 billion on tanks and planes next year? I mean,
remember one of Trump's big bugaboos was that Europe wasn't meeting the... I think it was the 4% or threshold.
Oh, it's 2% of GDP is what it's supposed to be.
2% of GDP. Now you see countries like Denmark that are going for 5%. The Baltic countries are going for 5 or 6%. So, yeah, there is now a major push.
Well, I mean, I think Germany is still the one that's lagging, right? Somebody is. I mean,
and even Canada, I believe, is now... increase their defense spending. I don't know what percentage it is. Maybe they're going up to 3 or 4.
But we got a dash here, Wayne. Thank you again for coming up. We were happy for years to have our guys doing all their practice flights on the Canadian northern border. Pretty tough to turn around and say, okay, now it's your job. We don't want to do it anymore. Well, it's just going to take time. It's not that they shouldn't be doing it. I mean, I'm not arguing that part, but I mean, you just turn around and say, well, we're out of here. You guys should have been doing it all the time. Wait a minute. The guy was just in here, said he didn't want us doing it. I mean, this one last question, and this is are we as a country, you know, maybe you and I won't be around to see it, somewhere in the next 50 years, are we going to get back to some sort of a level-headed politics where the first thing somebody does when he gets in office, and this, they both did this, so it's not like where the first thing you do is reverse all the other guys did and start your new stuff. I can't think of a crummier way to govern than that.
Yeah, I with Trump yesterday getting into it with New York saying he's the king, I think those days are over. I don't know where we're heading, but I think that the days of reaching across the aisle and all that stuff, I think it's going to be ancient history soon.
Well, I tell you what, I agree with him about the concentration tax in New York. You can't drive your car in there unless you pay. I mean, I'm with him on that. I don't know where that comes from, because all the idiots in Chicago are looking around to do the same thing, even though we don't have anybody. I mean, whatever. Anyway, Wayne, thank you. Talk at you next week. SP Futures down 15. Yeah. NASDAQ Futures down 44. Back tomorrow. Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.